This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Lisbeth Tom has written a book titled Tessa and Claudine, subtitled Finding My Sister, and she joins me from Georgia today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to visit with you. This is not your first novel. This is a fictional work. Share with my listeners a little of the background story. Where does this event, this story, this action take place?
Well, I chose the, first of all, the setting. It starts in a small town, it's a fictional town. It's a small town in southern Illinois. And the title is Tessa and Claudine. It's just a story of two sisters. And it's totally fictional names. And these sisters are very close in age, and it's a tender tale of these sisters and their tumultuous mother, they're very troubled mothers. So sisters battle with their differences and attempt to find acceptance within themselves and with each other.
You have the subtitle, Finding My Sister, which gives the impression that perhaps they are separated somehow. Was this an emotional separation or a physical separation you're referring to?
Well, it's basically a psychological family drama, and the sisters are emotionally separated. They are very close as young girls. And as the story starts, Tessa is the protagonist. She tells the story, and she's 16 years old, and she and her sister have drifted apart. They're very, very different in personality, and the sisters at this point have drifted apart, and this is the one thing she longs for, is to be close to her sister again.
Is this present tense, or is this?
She's trying to find her sister.
Trying to find her.
She used to have.
And reconnect with that sister that she remembered as a child.
Correct.
Is there a particular time frame? When does this story take place?
This story takes place in the late 50s, early 60s.
Is there anything in your novel and the storyline that is a reflection of observations you've made as you were growing up?
Yes, indeed. The book is, parts of the book are based on my own life. It is emotionally autobiographical. It is a fiction. However, it's a combination of fact and fiction. The characters are fictional. However, I went through some of the experiences that I portray in my book. But I've changed, I changed a lot of the details. What I have done is, I basically have followed author Wallace Stegner's advice. He advises to, if you're going to write about things that happen to yourself, to use a strong fictional framework, and that's exactly what I've done. I have used parts of things that have happened to along the way for me, and then I just turn that into fiction.
Who is your target audience, Elizabeth, as you were writing this?
My target audience is, it's mostly a women's story, and my target audience is especially women who have sisters. That's the message I'm trying to get across. I think I wrote the book because I had one sister, and she died in a car accident. So after she died, I realized that we were very different in personality, and I just felt like I could have gotten to know her better or accept her more for the person she was. So I think there's just a lot of people out there who will relate. I know there are, because I've talked to people, and many people say, well, my sister and I are so different. So I just want people to look beyond the sister they wished for and embrace the one they have.
That's good advice.
And actually, whether it's a brother or a sister, really a sibling. And that's really my intent in writing the book.
I can relate to that concept. I have two sisters. They're older, but both of them are different personalities. One is more of the nurturer. The other one is a little more aloof and reserved. And they have communication issues. that story should resonate with the reader.
As you began to write this, did you form an outline before writing it, or did you just begin with inspiration? You have 266 pages, which is a fairly ambitious book. How did it begin?
Well, I just started, you know, Tessa's 16 years old, and I started at that point, so I don't use an outline. No, the answer to that is definitely no. I started with an incident. I started with Tessa. She's involved in a car accident when she's 16 years old, and that's pretty traumatic because she loses her front teeth. There's a lot of very serious things going on in her life at that point, so I start with, you know, a real slide downhill. You know, it's kind of like up till that point, things are going fairly smoothly. So I put a lot of conflict in the beginning, and just the conflict between the sisters, between the mother and the two girls. There's basically a triangle in this whole story. I was told by a psychologist who was in a writer's group that I attended that what I had going was something called a Karpman triangle, mm-hmm. where these people were just locked in this triangle, that the mother becomes a wedge between the two girls, and it was pretty interesting to hear about. I didn't realize that was what I was doing. So
you were doing the right thing even though you didn't know you were doing the right thing.
I didn't know I was doing the right thing. Sometimes that happens.
It happens.
So I think I've done this with a lot of my writing, is I get a starting point, and I pretty much have just an idea of the ending. Actually, the ending didn't end up, I didn't end the story the way I thought it was going to, but that's what I've done. In my first novel, I did that. In this novel, I had a beginning and an end, and then just sort of worked out. My characters usually get a life of their own, and they help me along the way.
That's a good thing.
I don't know if that makes sense.
That's a good thing. Elizabeth, as you began to pursue your career as an author, were there other authors that you enjoyed reading, and if you could have a wish come true, hope that your stories meet with the same acceptance as others?
Well, there definitely are other authors that have inspired me. One author that inspired me a lot was Elizabeth Berg. Elizabeth Berg writes about things that happen to ordinary people, just ordinary things that happen to ordinary people, and I feel like that's what I try to do. I write about things that happen to ordinary people, and I have to admit I throw in a few little quirks that maybe don't always happen to ordinary people. But for the most part, I write in a similar way, or at least I have been told that I do. Elizabeth Berg wrote a lot of books: The Pull of the Moon, Range of Motion, Talk Before Sleep, Durable Goods. There's just a whole list of books that she's written. And there's other authors. I mentioned Wallace Stegner. He taught creative writing classes at Stanford University. And I don't know that I write like him, but I've learned a lot from his writing. He wrote a lot of books about settling of the West. And I like a lot of the famous authors. Well, he's a famous author, and so is Elizabeth Berg, but certainly Faulkner and Hemingway. And Annie Lamott is a wonderful author, and she's written one of my favorite writing books, you know, to learn the process of writing. It's called Bird by Bird.
Mm.
That's a great book.
Character-driven novel that you've written, as the characters drew you into their story as you were writing, is there a scene or maybe a section of the novel that really stands out? Maybe you could share a little bit of that with us.
Yes, there really is. I talked about the beginning of the book being fairly traumatic for Tessa. It's really traumatic for both sisters. And I have a scene that I could read about that. The mother, Eva May is quite the character, and she's a very troubled person. And she tells the girls, she announces to the girls, she gives them 4 days' notice that they're going to be leaving their small town. She's divorcing their stepfather, and she just says, you know, pack your bag, we're moving away. They're going to move to Indianapolis, which for the girls is quite the big city compared to the small farm town that they live in. So I have a scene from when they get on the bus to leave town, and I could read that if you'd like.
I would love to hear that.
Okay, right at noon, the Lutheran church bells rang. I paused to listen as I boarded the bus. Claudine and I sat down in seats halfway back on the left side of the blue and silver scenic cruiser. I sat beside the window, Claudine on the aisle. Mother sat four rows behind us on the right side on the aisle. Once we got settled in our seats, Claudine made irritating noises with her blackjack gum. I hate the smell of blackjack. I glanced back at Mother and then quickly turned back around. I didn't want to see her. Moving was one thing, but giving us only 4 days' notice really irked me. What was she trying to do, send us to the psych ward? I loved my mother, but I often disliked her. At that moment, I didn't like her all that much. When the uniformed driver pulled away from the curb, I felt like yelling, "Stop the bus and let me off." Of course, I didn't. Instead, I clenched my fist and stared out the window. The bus was leaving town, and so was I. "I feel like we're headed to the middle of nowhere," I said. "We are," Claudine said, turning the page of her movie magazine.
That's great texture. I'm drawn into the story and think I'm on the bus already, so that is so wonderfully done. Elizabeth, do a recap of your book and get my listeners interested in purchasing a copy of your book.
Well, I would just describe this book as a tender tale of Tessa and Claudine, two sisters that deal with their tumultuous mother, their troubled mother. They strive to be independent, but they really do not give up on their family, and they battle differences, the differences they have between each other and the differences they have with their mother, and they just attempt to find acceptance within themselves and with each other. There's some pretty tragic things that happened in this book, and I think the reader's going to stand up for these girls.
Beautiful.
And root for them to get back together.
Action and character-driven book. There must have been some challenges in getting this to print. What were those, and how did you overcome them?
Well, there's always challenges. You know, there's the fun part of writing, and then you run into the marketing, and that, of course, can provide stumbling blocks. And I worked really hard with my first novel. I had, you know, rejections are not exactly exciting. I had 75 rejections, and I finally got it on the market. And so I had that to face once again, and I just plowed my way through and found a way to get it published.
Congratulations on the completion of this book, Tessa and Claudine, Finding My Sister, our author, Lisbeth Thom. That's LISBETHTHOM. Lisbeth, where do we get copies of your book?
Well, when this book comes out, which will be shortly, you can get copies on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and you can get copies on my website at lisbeththom.com.
Fabulous. I'm assuming, because of your love of writing and storytelling, that perhaps there's something else in the future, and we hope to visit with you when that comes out as well.
Well, thank you. I would enjoy that.
Thank you for joining me today for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Six of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear the latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing Crossbooks. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Ushering with a Mission, a training manual for the development of the usher's ministry. And our pastor who's joining us and author of the book, Dr. Victor L. Davis. Dr. Davis, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Jay, for inviting me to share.
There are people that are listening to me that are wondering what an usher is. They're thinking of the theater and popcorn. What is your usher ministry relating to?
Well, you know, the usher's ministry first really is the first line of your public relations effort to reach out into your community. And very much as stores understand how important public relations is in terms of their profitability, even so, churches now have discovered that the ushers play a very, very important role in terms of making first impressions upon not only those who are visiting, but have a lasting impression upon those who are members of the congregation. And so it is a very, very important that those individuals are trained and equipped and gifted, really, to carry out their very important ministry of the church.
I like the term gifted because it is an important function in a church community setting. I have been involved just personally in church settings, and it's a complicated issue. You don't want to have a church family that is too institutionalized, I guess would be the word I would use, or too much like a society or a club. You want people that are embraced when they walk through the door, and that's the first line, the ushering ministry, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. In fact, it is a well-known fact that people who visit a church will often make their decision with reference to whether or not they're going to return within the first 5 minutes of their encounter there, and many times long before they have an opportunity even to enter into the sanctuary or hear the message or even hear the choir or experience the congregation, the first people they can often meet will be those we refer to as ushers, or in some settings, the greeters ministry, mm-hmm. are those individuals who are charged with helping to make positive first impressions. So they play a very, very important role in how people react when they have a first encounter with their congregation.
Doctor, this is your first publication that's been hopefully nationally distributed. Why did you decide this was an important topic and you wanted to jump in the middle of it?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. It was a difficult thing for me to do because at first, you know, I had a member of our congregation who was an usher and was experiencing some difficulty in her ministry, and asked if there were some resources out on the market that could help her. And so I looked around, and what was out there was just not adequate. It may have addressed techniques in terms of ushering, but as a pastor, I was more concerned about a person's spiritual development, their concept of the ushers as a ministry versus just a function that they carried out. And so the Lord placed upon my heart to begin developing some material on my own. And actually, it started off as a little notebook, and that I was literally giving away when I was invited to do a workshop. And to make a long story short, I had a friend of mine who was in the publishing business who saw it. And it took him about 3 years of just beating me over the head, saying, Victor, you're onto something. You're really meeting a need that is out there in our congregations. And so he assisted me and encouraged me and coached me. And so we published it. And I'll be honest with you, I was overwhelmed in terms of the response that we did receive as a result of the publishing of the book. To find out that what I was experiencing in my own little setting there at the church I was pastoring was being duplicated or encountered by other pastors and other people in their congregations. And so the response has been quite favorable as a result of its publication.
You have shared a concept that not many, in fact, I'm not familiar with, titled the 2-6-4 principle. What does that entail?
Well, actually, we use that 2-6-4 concept to really help encapsulate what ushering with a mission and the ministry and the foundation upon which this ministry is built. The 2 stands for the 2 reasons why a person should usher, and we identify that as the Great Commission and the Great Commandment, the Great Commission, which really tells us to go into all the world and share the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the Great Commandment really is to love the Lord with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And we say that ushers, really, if you want to usher, if you want to be a part of this usher's ministry, they need to be the 2 primary reasons why you serve as an usher. The six stands for the six functions or the six purposes for which each usher's mission should exist. And we identify those six functions as worship, discipleship, evangelism, fellowship, ministry and missions. And then we also, and we actually say ministry and missions, we kind of consider them as one, one being what takes place within the context of the church and their missions being beyond the walls of the church. But then we also include stewardship as those six functions. All ushers' ministries really should address each and every one of those functions. And when we have that two in place, the two great purposes, when we have that six in place, the six functions in, that each of those ministries should be about, then there are going to be four very positive results that we address in our book. So that's what that 264 basically addresses.
Where did the concept of ushering actually begin? I don't recall that in any of my New Testament studies of the book of Acts or any of the other New Testament churches. Where did this concept begin, do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you said that because we actually do in our, when we do our workshops in our book, and in our usher training, we talk about the biblical foundation of the usher's ministry. And although we don't find the term usher in the Bible, yet we realize that the ushers are servants in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And we note many examples of individuals who are servants in the Old Testament. We even talk about how, you know, there is one in the Old Testament who talks about, I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of the Lord than to dwell in the tents of the wicked.
True.
And so we talk about the temple guards who in many ways served as ushers, and we also identify those who were servants in the early church. Now, I know when we look in the book of Acts, and there's been some discussion with reference to Acts chapter 6 and those who, quote-unquote, were appointed as, identified as, quote-unquote, the beginning of the deacon's ministry.
Right.
But although they were not identified or called deacons in that particular passage, yet we see the evidence of servanthood there. And so this concept of being servant is one that we see both in the Old and New Testament. And what we do is basically pattern and model the training that we do after the servanthood teachings that we find both in the Old and New Testament scriptures.
Would you consider your book a training manual for pastors only, or who else is going to benefit from this?
Well, actually, the actual ushers are the ones. Now, we do encourage, in fact, we have many pastors who participate in our usher training because we, in essence, say that the pulpit or those who are worship leaders, those who are pastors, and those who are on the floor, those who are ushering, really are a team and need to be able to communicate in order that the worship service may flow smoothly, that the needs of the congregation may be met. And so, we say all that, the pastors certainly are welcome, but it is those who are the ushers who are the primary beneficiaries of the usher training.
One thing I noticed from the photo on the cover of your book, you have a beautiful sanctuary that's highlighted there, plus a couple of very fine and cheerful-looking individuals that have their hand out. I don't know if they're taking the offering or whether they're just inviting you or welcoming you to the church. One of the things that's happening in the church that I see as an observer, and I'm in Texas where the heat seems to be 140 in the shade all the time, although it's not, the casual dressing of the attenders and the people who are ushers, are you finding any resistance to what I would call informal formal dress in your congregations?
Well, I've had opportunity to do usher training and workshops all across the country, east and west, north and south, and that is a very localized decision. I find that in some of your more southern settings, there have a tendency to be more traditionalized, feeling that church is something you need to dress up for.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when I get out to the West Coast or when I'm down in Florida, where you have those temperatures, or you actually have a more laid-back culture, and even a younger generation, we find that the dress code is more relaxed. And so that's a decision that I think must be dealt with by the local congregation. Ultimately, our concern ought to be what will enhance our effectiveness in terms of reaching the people we want to reach. I think Paul even talks about, I'll be all things to all people, in order that I might win some. And so, the attire should never stand in the way of those who we seek to minister to. And so it may mean that we may have to sacrifice in some ways in terms of, I may come from a culture in which it is preferred that you are more formal in your attire. And if I move out to California and I feel called to be a part of an usher's ministry at a church that has a more relaxed kind of attitude towards that attire, then, we say that ushers must be flexible, because the ultimate goal is not that people focus their attention on who we are as ushers, but our focus must be on the people we are trying to reach and that we are trying to serve. And if it means making those kinds of adjustments in order that we might be a more effective in terms of our witness, then we must be open to those kinds of changes.
Well, I think they should at least have matching Hawaiian shirts. just to make
well, you
it.
Know what? You know what? We try to tell. In fact, in just a couple of weeks, I'll be conducting an usher workshop in North Carolina, in Asheville, North Carolina, in a conference known as the Ridgecrest Conference Center. And when the ushers come to that training session, they do not come with uniforms. They don't even come with matching attire. And what we try to tell them there is that when we serve during the evening worship services, people ought to know that they're ushers not by their attire, but by their demeanor, by their smile, by the way they greet people, by the way they interact with people. And so it isn't the uniform, but it is what we like to say, the Christ in you that identifies you as a servant of the Lord. And so that's where our emphasis needs to be, not so much in the uniformity of our external attire, but in the manifestation of the spirit of love in what we are clothed on in the inside.
Beautiful advice. There are other books in the marketplace, I'm sure, that deal with this topic. Why is yours unique?
Well, believe it or not, there aren't that many. Again, the thing that makes us so unique is the fact that, we just don't deal with ushering techniques. Many books out on the market, many training models that are out on the market deal with ushering techniques. They talk about how you stand. Even there's some signals that ushers often use in communicating in a nonverbal way when they are serving in the context of the worship service. There, though there are there's material that deals with that. We primarily focus on the discipleship element. We really believe that we seek to help individuals mature in their faith and to become better disciples of Christ, because we really feel that the best ushers are those who are committed disciples of Christ. And so we have a strong emphasis on spiritual development and maturity, and that's why we focus on those six areas, because our material is designed, our resources are designed to help them grow in their understanding of their ushering as a ministry, that we're called to take it seriously as a ministry. I think you had identified a little earlier in our talking how you found it very challenging. Well, sometimes the greatest challenges come because people who are serving in the usher's ministry feel they do it because they can't do anything else in the church.
Right.
They can't sing, or they don't feel qualified to do anything else, so they say, well, I guess I'll try to be an usher. But we really feel as though ushering is something that needs to be taken just as seriously as someone who feels that they are being called to pastor or called to a music ministry or any other area of service in the context of the church. It is a calling, and we seek to equip those who feel called to that particular area of service.
Well, Dr. Davis, thank you for sharing your story about this book. There must have been some challenges in getting this written and published. What were those?
Well, I guess the greatest challenge was me just sitting down and writing the book. I've often heard, I have a friend of mine who says the greatest enemy that he had in carrying out his work was in me, if you can help me to.
Absolutely.
It was inside of me. And the greatest challenge was really just having the discipline to sit down and isolate myself to get away so I could literally write this book. But I'm so glad that that did happen. I'm so glad that I had the encouragement of my friend, who's since gone on to be with the Lord, Dr. George McCaleb, who was the former pastor of the Green Forest Baptist Church in Decatur, Georgia. But also thank God for my wife, who was such a support to me and such an encouragement to me in helping me to just get this work done.
This book is titled Ushering with a Mission, a Training Manual for the Development of the Usher's Ministry. Our author and pastor, Dr. Victor L. Davis. Dr. Davis, where can we get copies of your book?
Well, you can go online and just simply type in ushering with a mission .com or ushertraining.com. usheringwithamission.com, or look us up on Facebook, Ushering with a Mission, where we can be found all in all of those ways. And it will also has been picked up by Lifeway Christian Resources and should be available in their bookstores nationally within the next couple of weeks.
Dr. Davis, thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for allowing me to share.
For Indie Book Publishing, Cross Books, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Trafford Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Our book today is titled From a Note to a Novel, and our author is Sanaj. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This,
happy to be here.
An interesting title, 136 pages. This is your first novel or first attempt. Share with my listeners what type of book this is and where the title came from.
Well, I have always felt like I had a few books in me. So I lost my husband in 2004, and there were a lot of things that happened with me and my children that I felt would be good to share for people who experience loss, you know, because there's always something crazy that goes on in families at the time of a death. And I basically just wanted to share parts of those stories. And I just felt like there was a lot that I wanted to share. And From a Note to a Novel provided a platform for me to do that.
Would you describe it as a fictional work, nonfiction, narrative? How would you best describe this book?
Well, I would say nonfictional. I mean, I'm telling real-life stories, and, I would say fictional and nonfictional because I'm sharing dreams, which are, you know, my dreams.
Yeah, how long ago did you begin writing your book, your novel?
I began the process a little over a year ago, really on a challenge from a friend, because I was always posting inspirational things. I felt like if what came into my spirit to write helped me, and it always did, I figured I was the first partaker, and I wanted to help and empower other people. Not saying that my life was grand or everything was perfect, but just showing people how I worked through certain difficulties. And I enjoyed that. And on a challenge from a friend who said, hey, I think you ought to write a book. And I said, okay. And I took a stab at it.
That's an interesting challenge. I've had challenges in my life. People have told me to do a few things that I preferred not to do. But you decided that being a novelist, being an author, was something that you wanted to take on. That's commendable. You have 136 pages. As you begin to write this, where did you think this might take you? Are you excited enough about being an author that you might want to share additional stories?
Yes, actually. I basically have always thought that writing a book was something I wanted to do. I always felt like I had a couple of books in me. And I didn't know where it would take me. I only hoped I'd be able to help some people along the way, along my journey. So So I really had no expectations. I only hoped for the best. And it's been quite rewarding.
As you completed this book and as you were in the process of putting it into print, was there a specific audience that you thought might find this appealing? Is it designed more towards the female audience, the male audience, or is it a cross-section?
Well, it's a cross-section because both male and female experience death and grief. Right. So I wanted to touch as many people as possible. Basically, anyone in a grieving process. And I guess some of the stories are funny. Some of them are serious. You know, the book will make you laugh. It will make you cry. It will make you go, huh? So it's very provoking, in my opinion. So it's informative. I just wanted to be able to touch people's lives in a lot of different ways, to inspire, to inform, you know, and to make somebody laugh.
You mentioned, at least in some of your notes, that you have seen things like fights that have broken out at funerals. Is this something you personally have observed, or have you been
involved in? I mean, on the internet, on YouTube,
sure.
I've seen that. But I've been told stories of people who were at funerals where fights broke out, and it was like, wow. And in my experience with the loss of my husband, I can see how things can become so volatile that they go to that level. That's not been my experience.
Glad to hear that part. What was the aspect of grief counseling? Were you able to participate? Was your family able to participate in some counseling during this difficult time?
Absolutely. Counseling was pivotal. I think that I got as far as I did, or I have, because of the influence that grief counseling had on me, because it put me in an atmosphere where I wasn't alone. I mean, there were people there who were going through the same things as I was going through, and we were able to share and, I don't know, lean on each other and give each other the support that we needed. Even in our grief, you know, there were so many positives that came out of it. And I think that having access to grief counseling was just one of the best things that could have happened to me, because I was going through so much, and it was totally supportive and engaging and empowering. And I don't know that I'd have done as well as I have without it.
Our authors that I talk to, I've talked to probably 1,000 different authors, and creativity, of course, is a major important aspect of publishing any book, whether it's a fictional or non-fictional work. When do you feel the most creative?
I feel the most creative in the wee wee hours of the morning, when everything is quiet and still, and I'm able to just listen to the universe. And it is a powerful thing for me. If I have questions before I go to bed, or have some anxiety before I lay down the night before, usually I'll have clarity in the wee hours of the morning, and it gives me the strength and the power to put both my feet on the floor and continue with this life I live.
You have children, and this has been a difficult time, correct?
Yes. I have 3 children, and it's been, my oldest son was a week before his 7th birthday when my husband's accident happened.
Mm.
And so for 10 years, I've been raising 3 kids on my own. My boys were almost 7 and 4, and my daughter was 12 at the time, so she's grown now. But it's been quite an experience. I've learned a lot, and my children have actually taught me a lot of lessons along the way. It seems that, let me tell you a story. My son, who was almost 7, my husband was a buyer for a manufacturing plant, and the home office was in Tennessee. So every so often, he'd have to go away for a few days, Tennessee, and we lived in South Carolina. So every time he'd have to go away, he'd get down on one knee, and he'd put his hand on my son's shoulder, and he'd say, "Arlen, Daddy's got to go away for business, so I'm leaving you as man of the house. I want you to take care of your mama." And, you know, I would be standing there with my arms crossed going, "Yeah, right." But when my husband died, I believe my son heard my husband's voice in his ear saying, "Hey, I'm going away, but I need you to take care of your mama." And I'm telling you, on that day, it was as if all three of my children stood up. And in one sense, they stood up because all I could see was myself on the floor, because it was one of the most devastating things that I'd ever experienced. But it was like they grew up in a moment. You know, they all took more responsibility. I just have terrific kids. You know, I'm just glad that my husband left such great footprints in my son's life, in my children's lives.
Beautiful.
Because not one time have I been disappointed. I'm so grateful for that.
That's an incredible legacy just on its own. And very, very blessed that you have that. That shares some positive input, not only to my listeners, but also it comes through in your book. If you were to introduce this to someone in a couple of paragraphs, how would you do so to get them interested in sharing in your journey from a note to a novel?
From a note to a novel, the note is representative of the stories I tell, and I really wish that I had expanded on the stories in the book. And the novel represents my life. We go from, you know, all the little stories, and there are many, but they transition into the life I live. So from a note to a novel, I love it. I think the title just came to me, and I love it. And I think that once people read it, and I think they'll get me, and I think they'll encourage others to read the book. At least I'm hoping they will.
There's more than just tragedy in here. There is insight into the personality and the character of a life that was well-lived, and other things. Yeah, you've gone back and just told personal stories as well. One of the things that stands out to me was there was a note that you discovered, and in that note it said, "Dates that will impact the rest of my life." Three dates were mentioned.
Yes, that was the date we had our first son, the date we got married, and the date that we found his father. Now, my husband did not meet his father until he was 32 years old. And I can tell you a brief story. When we first started dating, whenever we talk about something, or whenever I had some concerns about decisions I was making in my life, I would always mention, you know, "I'm going to talk to my dad about this. I'm going to see how my dad feels about this."
Mm-hmm.
And my husband would always say, "Why do you talk to your dad about everything?" And he said that to me like one too many times. And then it dawned on me, he doesn't understand the presence my dad has, or the influence my dad has in my life, because that is a relationship that he has never known. So in my watching Oprah over the years and finding people, I thought I'd set out on a journey to find his dad. And it took a bit of doing, but we ended up finding him. It took probably more than a year to locate this man, but we found him. And I wanted him to know what it felt like to have a dad who was fully present and available. And when we did find him, it was like crazy happiness. But my husband said to me one day, he said, "Janice, any woman probably could have given me son, but you gave me my dad, and I will love you forever just for that." You know, so these are things, I mean, it seems like I recall more of our conversations like it was yesterday. But it's good for me. And, it, you know, these are the things that I can reflect on. And rather than being sad or crying about it, it makes me smile that I had someone in my life who loved me unconditionally. And however brief it was, because I would love for it to have been a lifetime, but it was. It was his lifetime. You know what I'm saying? And,
yes.
And for the rest of my lifetime, I have those memories that will, you know, help me along my way.
Sanaj, I know you're working on a second book. What is the title of that? Have you already completed it?
I have completed a second work, and it is called Strength and Weakness by Sanaj. And actually, this is a continuation of the previous story. Hope everyone enjoys.
Fantastic. And the correct spelling of your pen name is S-I-N-N-A-J. This book is one that is a short read, 136 pages, from a note to a novel. Sanaj, where do we get copies of your book?
You can get the book on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. And if you try maybe your local bookstore, they may be able to order it and get it in the store for you.
Do you also have a website yet, or is that under development?
We do have a website. It is called From a Note to a Novel, which I am also doing a blog. And I'm very excited. I really would like to push traffic to the website. So I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to have this interview. Thank you.
Well, Sanaj, pleasure visiting with you. Thank you for sharing the background story into this, your first book, From a Note to a Novel. Listeners, you can do a search online and find more details about Sanaj and her activities and perhaps the next book that comes out. For Indie Book Publishing, Trafford Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.